Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Economist Asks. I'm Anne McElvoy, head of Economist Radio. And today we'll be asking whether a new generation of leaders in the Balkans can change a region marred by wars in the 1990s and frozen conflicts since. Last June, Ana Brnabić became the first woman and first openly gay person to take up the office of Prime Minister of Serbia. After the breakup of Yugoslavia in the wake of the Cold War's end, the Balkans find themselves walking a tightrope between two major power blocs, the European Union and Russia, and not just on big power questions. So I'll be asking her what she would say to President Putin on his poor record on homosexual rights. Closer to home, there are challenges too. On the 17th of February 2018, Kosovo will mark the 10th anniversary of its unilateral declaration of independence from Serbia. But many ghosts haunt these two countries and their neighbours. So Serbia carries a heavy weight as it tries to chart a new path between East and West. I met Prime Minister Brnabić at the World in 2018 event in Hong Kong. At the top of her list is EU accession for Serbia, which seems to be a settled will in Belgrade, but a lot of things that are happening in the country do seem to pull against it, not least the clampdown on media freedoms recently. I started by asking her, to put it bluntly, how she expects to get into the EU against that background.
As for the media, it's a very interesting question for me, because I do not see in which way the media freedom in Serbia is under question, because we have more than, I think right now, 1,600 media outlets. So a really huge, unsustainable number. But that's due to media strategy, which was also in the set of media laws.
So there's no pressure on independent media in Serbia coming from the government. Are you absolutely sure you can say that?
I'm absolutely sure I can say that. I haven't seen any government which is more open to inviting all the media for their events, responding to questions from all the media outlets, and really being open.
So the independent publishers, who can, I think there are about 150 who complain that they're under undue pressure, have it wrong, in your opinion?
In my opinion, yes. But having said that, I completely understand that I'm obviously not objective enough because I'm the Prime Minister and, you know, I have my own view. So I try to keep a dialogue open with all of these outlets who are now grouped in this group called Group for Free Media. I invited them for the meeting and I said, we are coming from, you know, we have a very different view on the media freedoms in Serbia, but I want to hear you. And I think the media plays one of the key roles in building up a truly democratic society, in pushing for reforms. And I want to be able to understand you, but at the same time, I want you to be able to understand me and the government and the president, for that matter, where we are coming from. And because I think that dialogue needs to happen so that we are not polarized society.
Let's talk about your role. You're relatively new to government. You're kind of a newcomer among the prime ministers in Europe, a relatively young woman, quite an exciting development for Serbia. But how do you then relate to a powerful president who has a history and a sort of history that's rooted in a certain form of politics in Belgrade and a certain kind of nationalism in Belgrade? Are you the token liberal in the government?
First and foremost, I think that the current president, Vucic, I haven't ever met anyone who is working so hard on himself to actually understand that you know, the mistakes he has made, the mistakes he's making today, learn and improve himself. And I think it's a really, really, truly admirable characteristic that I think more politicians in general in the Balkans need to have. And I think that all of us can learn from it. Now, secondly, what he is and how he's perceived are two very different things. And when I joined the government in August 2016 as the Minister of Public Administration, I found it very, very easy to work with him. And he supported all of my decisions.
You are more liberal than he is, true?
Certainly on the surface, but it's also, you can't compare it because, in all honesty, I do not have that power that he does. I do not have this strong political party behind me. I have their support in the parliament, but, you know, it's I'm not a party member. And so, if I may say so, it's easier for me to be more liberal. You know, he, on the other hand, has pushed all of the truly liberal things in Serbia. The Brussels Agreement, which is very difficult to sign. He, at the end of the day, stood behind it. And he was widely criticized in Serbia for this. He's even criticized for it in the last presidential campaign from the so-called pro-democratic, pro-liberal candidates. He was the one for push for very, very unpopular fiscal consolidation measures, but much needed. In that, he pushed for a very liberal attitude. He was the one to actually support the labor law, very liberal, but resulted in a very flexible labor market and employment, which was more than half in the past 3 years. Now, he has pushed for the first female prime minister, openly gay prime minister, LGBT. And he's, you know, and he...
That's the point where people say, well, that's interesting. I mean, it's very good that you are out there and obviously as a great example for gay women in public life. But there is a suspicion that that was very useful to the ruling party because it gave the impression of a rather more cosmopolitan liberal outlook that is really there. How do you feel when you hear that?
I think that that's easy to say. I think that to actually do that in Serbia, to actually be brave enough to say, well, perhaps this might work and perhaps the people in Serbia will turn against me. So I think it was a brave political move. And I think that today it's easy to criticize it as merely a PR stunt. Mm-hmm. I think it's much.
Did you have any qualms, any worries about taking the job on those terms?
Well, listen, my only worry is that I wasn't experienced enough. That was my worry, and whether I'll be able to actually do the job. And Serbia doesn't have time to lose. I believed in myself. I also believed that, you know, I'll have the support of the president, who was the prime minister in the past 3 years, to actually clearly, you know, even with things that are not my major strength, and that's, for example, foreign relations and politics. But, you know, I think I'm a quick learner, if anything. And so, you know, I try hard. I learn every day and I try hard to promote and present Serbia in the best possible manner. And I think I make a very good team with the president. So, you know, we feel each other's gaps very well.
Let's come back to the thing that's so hard to get away from, can never really be got away from, and that's the recent war, the breakup of Yugoslavia and everything that's followed. We've just had those big verdicts come through in The Hague at the International Criminal Tribunal. General Mladic sentenced to life imprisonment, the Croatian general who dramatically took his life in front of the tribunal. Do these events on both sides, one Bosnian Croat, one Bosnian Serb, lead you to conclude that justice is being done and it's even-handed? Has Belgrade come to accept The Hague as a process?
Very difficult question. To be perfectly honest, I had meetings with the representatives of the Hague Tribunal, with Mr. Brammertz as well as the president of the Hague Tribunal. I do not think that the Hague has done justice to the wars in the former Yugoslavia, and I do not think it really contributed to reconciliation. And some might say, well, the reconciliation wasn't really the primary goal of the Hague Tribunal. I would disagree. I think that, you know, if it would have been perceived differently, then it would have brought about reconciliation.
But what could have been different after these dreadful events? I mean, you saw the charge sheet against General Mladic, Srebrenica, everything that happened, and of course there are atrocities on both sides here. But what is wrong with this process? What would have worked better?
I would not argue about the convictions themselves. I would actually argue for the people who weren't convicted, because I think that, you know, we really had terrible crimes in the Operation Storm. More than 200,000, 250,000 people expelled from Croatia. Croatia basically ethnically cleansed. You had more than 2,000 people killed, and those people were basically... either the invalids or old people who could not flee. But no one was responsible at the end of the day. No one, all the generals were acquitted, Similarly to Bosnia, you had, and I don't want to say
Bosnian
that...
Bosnian Croats have been...
Bosnian Croats, but Bosnian Muslims weren't. I mean, there weren't anyone who was, on the Kosovo side, Kosovo Liberation Army. You can't say that there were no crimes committed against Serbs and other non-Albanians. But everyone, basically walked free. And that's why... But just to say, it's very difficult for me to talk about that because, again, when I say it, I don't think it will contribute to regional reconciliation. So my final point is, let's please look towards the future and leave this behind and really try very hard to say, new generations are coming, we have so many things in common, we have to look towards the future. And also, that was one of the additional controversies in my appointment, is that my grandfather is Croat. That's my father's father is Croat, and he's not, Serb from Croatia. He's a Croat from the island of Krk. I spend a lot of my time in the childhood there. I have many friends there. I love to go there. I go there often. And so I think that those kind of things show that we have many things in common, that we need to look towards the future, that we...
It sounds to me like you want to move on almost faster than any country can. And we won't stick on this forever, but there's just one or two little...
Nodding. Yeah. No, please. I think that it's important. I want to be able to really openly and honestly discuss these issues.
But then let me put to you just a sort of crunchy point about language. It is still officially in Belgrade the case that the word genocide is not accepted for what happened, particularly with what looked like, for many of us covering it on the ground as reporters, trying to be even-handed, what looked like something that did deserve the name of genocide. You talk about crimes. That seems to be now the language of choice. Is there a reason, if you like, for haggling with The Hague and others and the UN who have used the term genocide?
Well, I don't think it was a genocide. It was a terrible, terrible, terrible crime. I don't think it was a genocide because... it wasn't an action which basically said we are going to kill all the people there so there are no Muslims anymore there.
You don't have to exterminate everyone for it to be a genocide.
I think in the definition of genocide, you have to. So you kill children and you kill women and you kill...
Isn't that what happened in Srebrenica and elsewhere?
That did not happen in Srebrenica. So I think that...
There were no young people killed, children, or people under 16 killed in Srebrenica.
I To be honest, I do not think it was a genocide. But it's so difficult for me to talk about that because it was a terrible crime. And one of the crimes that I do feel ashamed also personally because it was done, because it portrayed Serbs in a way that I do not think our country should be portrayed. Because I do truly believe it, again, going back to an easier issue of LGBT and, Serbia being perceived as this very homophobic, very Balkan conservative nation, I don't think we are. I actually think that Serbs are a very open-minded, generous people, not perhaps, open-minded, but people who at the end of the day do not judge others by whether they're Muslims or Croats or gay or straight, but are good people or not good people. So that's why I love about my country. And I feel, I cannot say how terribly I do feel for the 90s and what was done in the name of Serbs. I don't think it's...
I understand that. And I can see you're genuinely moved by that. You're choosing your own way to describe it. But I wonder if you had the chance, would you have Yugoslavia back again?
No. I think it was a great country. I think it was a country which had a huge potential to do many positive things for Europe and the world. But since it broke up and in a way that it did, I would not try that experiment again. But I would want to see a very different Balkans. I would like to see a Balkans which is reconciled, a Balkans which works together, which does not have borders per se.
Would that include independence for Kosovo? Would you use the word independence?
I wouldn't use the word independence. I think using the word independence would as we said, open up Pandora's box that we see, in Catalonia today, that we could see in many other countries in Europe and across the world. I wouldn't say independence. But I think that what we're trying to do now is to find a long-lasting solution, not to leave the frozen conflict for the generations that are coming, And in that...
What is the halfway house to independence that could work? It would be accepted by Kosovo?
I don't have an answer to that question right now, but I hope we could find one in the months to follow. I hope we can find that one in 2018. I think we have a historic chance now to find a long-lasting solution. I think that we have all stars aligned. And if we do not find it now, if we do not use this chance in 2018, that chance will not repeat itself in the decades to follow.
Someone described the strategy of Serbia overall, the GO's strategy, as sitting on two chairs, looking towards Europe and European accession and mending relationships commendably with Germany, with Berlin on the one hand, but also a cozying up to Russia under Vladimir Putin, who seems to stand for an entirely different value system and has, also had his incursions or sponsored incursions into independent countries on the other. How long can you keep this strategy going of being on sort of both sides of that values divide?
Yes, this whole metaphor of two chairs is, I think, unfortunate one, and I keep saying that, it's not two chairs, it's one chair, it's Serbian chair. And we are completely for the EU, and that's our strategic goal. This is, and again, it's not because of the money, and that's very important to keep emphasizing. We are not promoting Europe as one big pot of money at the end of that journey. It's the system of values that we want to become part of.
Well, if you want to be part of the system of values, then you probably have to peel a bit away from a leader in Russia who has shown contempt for liberal values in the broadest sense, who has also, when it comes down to it, was quite happy to sponsor military incursions into Ukraine and to take back Crimea by force.
But Serbia has always been very, not always, And again, it's one of those Serbian terms, always or never. We have this, you know, we are people of opposites always. It's so not always, but in the past 3 years, I would say, in the past 3-4 years. And I think that was one of, again, big things that was changed by Vucic, is that we have started to have a very honest politics. For example, for Ukraine, we're friends with Russia, but we completely support territorial integrity of Ukraine. We do not support independent Crimea. We think that's one of these things that will open Pandora's box. So we support Ukraine very openly, very honestly. You know, we say this in the US, in Brussels, in Moscow. Also, the same is with our European integration. So,
what about Montenegro? What about a concrete situation on the ground where there seems to have been a change of leadership, which happened with a lot of support from Moscow? Does that make you feel comfortable? You're not that far away in Belgrade.
But listen, we have close ties with Moscow, obviously. But they stem from the tradition, from the religion, from this whole Slavic brotherhood, you know, the language and all of that. Also, from the economy and trade. We do have free trade agreement with Russia. It means a lot to us, but it's one of the free trade agreements we have. It's important because we try to build a stronger economy and increase our GDP, which is, I think, also important for the EU integration, because I think EU needs a strong partner, not the you know, impoverished potential member that everyone will then need to support. I think, on the contrary. And we have this, obviously, the energy relationship with Russia, because we are dependent on the Russian gas. So it's a complex relationship, but it's one of friendship, which always says, but our path is to the EU. And Putin and Moscow, they know that.
If you met Mr. Putin, I don't know if you have already.
No, I haven't.
If you have, I mean, one obvious area of vast difference is his treatment of minorities, not least homosexuals. What would you say to him?
Very good question. I'll see when I met him whether we will at all talk about this. But remember that it's not all of the EU countries treat minorities equally well. And there are some EU countries that also shy away from really treating minorities well.
There's not many of them with leaders who talk about homosexuals the way Vladimir Putin does.
Not many of them.
Any that I can think of.
No. Come on. That's true. But see, you know, the migration crisis, you know. I think in the migration crisis, Serbia has actually managed to prove that we do share all of the EU values. Some of the EU values that not even, you know, some of the EU members share. We had over 1 million migrants passing through Serbia. We currently have 4,000 migrants in Serbia. We never closed the borders. We never put up fences. We now provide schools, which I'm especially proud of, to the children who are in Serbia, migrant children. You know, we offered even citizenship to many of them. Unfortunately, they want to move on. But this is the image of Serbia that I think, you know, I want to portray, and I want to say this is the Serbia of tomorrow, the country which does actually share the EU values. And granted, there are issues to be resolved, but I think we're on the right track.
I should just ask you before we go, your English is clearly so fantastic. It comes perhaps as a surprise to a lot of people, not just as a Serbian prime minister, but to meet, you know, anyone from a completely different sort of linguistic background in Europe who speaks so well. And I think this is partly down to your education, which is a bit of Britain and a bit of America. So I'm going to ask you what you took with you from these two experiences. What's in your backpack from Britain and what from America?
I'd say that much more liberal from the US. Northwood University has advocated for a very, very liberal economy. And
in
one of my, in Michigan, yes, one of my, uh, one of my favorite subjects. I still go back to those textbooks. I wouldn't share all the views today as the prime minister, to be honest, but was economics of public policies, that every public policy has a consequence to the economy, and you really have to think hard about what really are the economics of your public policies. And for the MBA in the UK, I would say much more difficult than BBA in the US, much more difficult, and perhaps a little bit of conservatism. So I have these two different views that I take with me, and which help me enormously now in my new position.
And you brought back an interest in Britpop as well.
I have to say that when I became the Prime Minister, I got a very, very nice letter from the University of Hull congratulating me. I'm very proud of that letter. I hope to be able to go to have perhaps a lecture at the University of Hull when I go back. I'd love that. And my favorite band is Depeche Mode, so...
Maybe you could go and get an autograph at the same time.
I love Pulp as well. I would, yes, certainly I would love to meet, you know, some of the Britpop musicians.
We'll see what we can do. Prime Minister,
thank you so much. Thank you very much.
I'm Anne McElvoy. Thank you very much for listening. And if you have any thoughts on Prime Minister Brabnitz's interview with us, do send them to us, radio@economist.com or on Twitter @EconomistRadio. In London, this is The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.